All right, y'all, welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I am the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and I've recorded more than 5,000 interviews going back to 2003, all of which are available at scotthorton.org. We can also sign up for the podcast feed. The full archive is also available at youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. Okay, you guys, on the line, I've got Aaron Mehta from DefenseNews.com. Welcome to the show. How you doing, Aaron?
I'm good, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Happy to have you here. I love this subject. We've been covering this thing for years and years here. Unresolved issues in the F-35. Will they ever be resolved? It says here five F-35 issues have been downgraded but remain unsolved. A piece with, let me mention your co-authors here, Valerie Insinna and David B. Larder. And Valerie Insinna had done this huge piece last year, I guess, about a year ago, all about the F-35 there for Defense News. That's also worth looking at for sure. So I guess let's go through it. First of all, what does it mean that these issues have been downgraded? From what category to what here?
Yeah, sure. So just a brief history. As you mentioned, my colleague Val last year got a hold of some previously somewhat classified. It's FOUO, which isn't legally classified, but basically means we don't want to have to tell people about these stuff. Documents that basically laid out what are called Category 1 deficiencies for the F-35. That's defined as essentially issues that could cause death for the pilot, it could cause loss of damage to the airplane, basically means you can't operate the thing in combat or be able to perform and it's actually the missions it's supposed to do. Basically, Category 1 is bad. So that we found that there were 13 of these things at the time. And so this would have been covering through the end of 2018. So we did a big project on that, as you mentioned, and kind of ran through each of those individual issues. And finally, in April, managed to get follow-up, basically say, hey, you had these 13 issues, what's going on? What we were told is five of those problems were basically closed out. They solved them. They're not considered issues anymore. Three of those issues remain open, and they're still working on those, although at least one of them, they've just kind of thrown their hands up and said, hey, we're going to have to live with this. There are four new ones, which we, as of right now, don't know what those actually are, although we're certainly hoping to find out. And then there were five that had been switched to Category 2, considered going from Category 1 to Category 2 deficiencies. Essentially, what that means is these are issues that we know we need to just kind of keep an eye on, but we don't think they're going to actually impact mission. We don't feel there's real a chance of loss of life or loss of plane. They're just issues that we're aware of and we're going to keep an eye on, and we think we've mostly fixed. Now, some experts have argued, good government experts say, look, it's pretty easy for a program office like the one that runs the F-35 to say, hey, this was a Category 1. We did something. Now it's Category 2. We're not worried about it. It's kind of wishy-washy how they classify these things. And that's why we felt it was still important to highlight that, yes, these were brought from Cat 1 to Cat 2, which is an improvement on paper, but they're things worth keeping an eye on.
Mm-hmm. Well, so one thing that jumped out at me, and I'm not exactly sure if I understood this right, but this severe Category 1 problem where if they pull up 20 degrees, they lose control of the plane, which that's not even, you know, they shouldn't even stall at 20, but now all of a sudden they've lost their yaw and whatever other controls, and this is the kind of maneuver that they would definitely have to do if they were ever in a dogfight. It sounded like their explanation of how they solved that problem was they said, well, we made a software improvement that it was kind of weird language, but it read as though they were saying, you won't have to pull up to 20 degrees anymore. We've made your lateral turning abilities greater, so you won't have to pull up to 20 degrees, which will cause you to lose controls like this. Did I read that right? And did you laugh
basically
out loud at that part too?
Yeah, you know, so this is why the Category 1 versus Category 2 thing gets kind of wishy-washy, right? Is, you know, do they actually solve the issue of being able to do this? Not really. They basically created a workaround saying, well, if we do this, then you won't have to do the 20-degree change, as you mentioned. That's great in theory. You know, pilots have said, look, if you're in a dogfight with these things anyway, like that's, you're going to have to do what you have to do. You're not going to say, oh, well, I know I can't do the 20 degree. I got to go laterally instead and do this maneuver instead. No pilot in that situation is thinking in that way. It's just, you got to react. You got to do what you got to do. So yeah, that's one of those things where, yes, it is technically improved. They did kind of come up with a workaround solution. Did it actually solve the problem? I think your reading is right. It leaves a lot of questions about that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's one of the things where the F-35 is kind of a weird plane in that, you know, we always think of fighter jets as being designed for dogfighting or Top Gun stuff, that type of thing. And proponents of the F-35 and people who fly it say, you know, look, if we ever get in a situation where we're actually in a dogfight, something has gone really, really wrong, because the core concept of the F-35 is that way before an enemy can see you and sense you, you've been able to see him, sense him, and shoot him down. So people will say, hey, this, you know, when we did our original story about this particular issue, we talked to some people from the F-35 side, and they said, look, this isn't really a huge issue because you're never going to be in a dogfight. Then you talk to some Navy pilots and say, that's great in theory, but I don't want to ever be in a dogfight and find out that I can't go 20 degrees up and down. So it's kind of this weird issue where one side says it shouldn't be an issue, but we'll put in this fix, and the other side says that's really not that comforting.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I wasn't there or anything, but that sure sounds like an after-the-fact excuse that, well, the thing can't dogfight, so we'll just say it never was supposed to anyway.
Well, I'll say on that front, it's, to be fair to the F-35, the idea, this goes back history, because the F-35 was awarded, it's actually crazy to think about, they awarded the contract to Lockheed Martin to make this plane a month after 9/11. It was middle of October 2001. That's how old this thing is, and they're still going through some of the testing and developing it. It's famously messed up in the first decade plus of the program, really with the development, a lot of issues. One of the things that happened along there was that in 2009, Bob Gates, who was then Secretary of Defense, had started Secretary of Defense under Bush and then stayed on under Obama, was looking at the budgets and basically said to the Air Force, look, this F-22 plane, which is designed to be the dogfighting plane, looks great, but F-35 is our future fighter. End production in F-22 and focus on F-35. That was not a popular decision in the Air Force at the time and remains controversial among pilots still to this day. But ultimately, the plan had been, when they first were developing the F-35, that F-22 would be the dogfighting plane, F-35 would never get near other enemy planes. Now the F-35 has to fill both roles because there just aren't enough F-22s. Again, that's kind of the argument you'll get from people who say, hey, this thing was never designed to be that way. If you're a pilot now, you're saying, hey, for at least the last decade, we've known this thing could end up in a dogfight, so what are we doing about it?
Yeah. Now, well, so in all your coverage of this thing, I guess there's a couple of points of view I've seen about this. There are some that say this thing is just the Edsel. It's supposed to be a Lamborghini, and it's just nothing but a piece of junk, and it's never going to be anything but a piece of junk. And there are others who say, no, it has $1 trillion worth of problems with it, sure, but if you throw $1 trillion at it, those problems will be resolved one by one, and eventually we'll end up with a really great plane here. Where do you fall on that spectrum?
I'm probably somewhere in the middle. I mean, look, the first, you almost have to look at the F-35 program as two different programs. The first decade was an incredible example of mismanagement and cost overruns. Mismanagement both from the Pentagon and from the contractors. Primarily Lockheed Martin is the main contractor, but it has many subcontractors. You could argue the core design idea of the F-35 was flawed, which is that it was going to be one plane with three variants, one for the Air Force, one for the Navy, one for the Marines. And you'd have this way of all the parts would be common, everything would be simple, and there'd be slightly different systems. Ended up not being that way. The Marine F-35B, which is the Stovall variant, so basically it can land kind of flat down, is something I believe it's less than 30% common with the F-35A, which is the main model used by the Air Force. So the core concept of the F-35 kind of from go was doomed with bringing that version in. All that said, in 2012, kind of new leadership came in at the Pentagon who were running this office. This guy, Chris Bogdan, was a general for the Air Force, took over the program. And the very first thing he did was to very publicly light up Lockheed Martin and say, we can't trust these people. I don't want to work with these people. They're awful. We're going to have to figure something out. And that scared a lot of people into actually making some fixes. Lockheed sacked its leadership and brought in new leadership on this particular program. And there was some movement there for a couple of years. Now the relationship has kind of gone back to, I don't want to say normal, but there's been more tension in the last couple of years than there were for a few years. Point being, the first decade of this program is basically lost time. Yes, they were developing the plane. Yes, they were producing early crafts, but the number of planes was very small that was produced. There were a ton of issues with them, some of which are still being impacted today. And it was way overpriced and way behind schedule. It's improved since that kind of 2011, 2012 timeframe. But yeah, there's still a legacy of a lot of these issues. And the truth is, some of these issues just aren't going to get fixed because they're too fundamentally baked into the design of the planes.
Yeah. Such as a single engine isn't powerful enough to push a plane that heavy as fast as it needs to go to accomplish its missions, right? What are you going to do other than start all over again and design a double engine jet?
Yeah. And you talk about, there's been for years talks about trying to develop a second engine, a competitor engine. That just hasn't happened. Now the services are working on future engine concepts that they say could potentially flow back into the F-35, but those are seen more as technology demonstrators that are working really towards whatever the next fighter jet ends up being.
So Pierre Spray, I guess that's how you say it, the guy that designed the F-16, he gave an interview to this Canadian broadcaster. It'd be a few years ago now, but he said, listen, the reality is, and this is just, it's true. It's not the way they talk about it usually. But the F-35 is, in fact, perfect for its mission because its true mission is to separate the American people from their money. And that this is a jobs program for Lockheed, and especially for their executive vice presidents and their stockholders. And we're the fool, and they're parting us from our dollars. And that's the reason why it's not fast, it's not stealth, it can't climb, it can't turn, it can't dogfight, it can't carry more than two missiles at a time, it can't do anything worth a damn. If you eject, the helmet will break your head right off your shoulders, and on down the list, because it's not really supposed to be used in a war. It's supposed to be used just to continue on as this make-work project for this major company. And so sayeth the guy that designed the F-15 and the F-16.
Yeah, I mean, I know Pierre. Certainly, I've covered him in my time covering the Air Force. He's a legend in the field. He's also, I think, it's fair to say, on the more cynical side of these things. Look, the F-35, do I think, again, especially in that first decade, where there are a lot of people who figured, hey, there's a war on terror going on, the budgets are just going up, 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 and nobody notices if this thing takes longer than it should and costs more than it should because it'll be okay. Absolutely. There's the reality is you can't really deny that. That said, I do think, again, kind of in the second jet decade of its life, there are people who are trying to make this thing work. And we've seen it be used in operations. The Israelis have been using it for, I believe, almost 18 months now in combat operations. And everything we've heard from them is they're really happy with how it's operating. You've seen a number of partners around the world buying it, a number of who would like to buy it, but we aren't selling to them at this point in the Middle East. It's an expensive plane. The fact that partner nations continue to say, hey, this is the plane that we want to buy, I think does show that there is at least things they're seeing and belief that this is a good product. That said, again, is it ever going to be what they promised, which is the cure-all plane for all missions? No. Is it ever going to be a great dogfighting plane? I don't think so. What it's probably always going to be best at is something that stands off from, you know, an enemy, has long-distance sensors and radars and some black technology that's never really been made public, and some stealth capabilities, and can, you know, launch weapons and fill that mission. That's a useful mission for the military. Is it the mission that the main, and really the way this was designed to be, the only fighter that we would have for three decades is supposed to fill? I think that leaves a lot of gaps. And you're starting to see the Air Force in particular saying, okay, we got to figure out how to fill some of these gaps left over by the F-35. Mm-hmm. In terms of the industrial participation, zero question, very early on, the strategy for this plane from Lockheed Martin was, hey, let's get pieces made into every state. Let's make sure that every place has some sort of industrial participation so that it's basically politically impossible to kill this thing. If you go to F-35.com, which is Lockheed's main site, they have a map and it says there's 42 jobs in this state, 52 jobs in this state, and 3,000 jobs in this one impacted by the F-35. Some of those numbers are iffy, but it's a good argument that they can make to members of Congress saying, I believe it's every state minus two has some part of the F-35. That's not even getting into the international participation, which is a big part of the industrial plan, where countries all over the globe make parts for this and have work share to also encourage them to keep buying it. So yeah, 100% industrial strategy was built in from the beginning to basically make this thing impervious to being killed.
Yeah. And which is all funny because it's just a simple case of the seen versus the unseen. When this money's going into this jet, it's not really going anywhere else. Whereas if the money was being invested in producing actual goods and services for the free economy, that would actually be, you know, productive for the gross domestic product and all this. This thing is more like a black hole. You just keep shoving money in to no effect at all, other than the people who are directly getting it. But, you know, that's a 150-year-old lesson in economics that nobody's learned since then, I guess.
Yeah, I'd say you could say that for probably every product that the Defense Department spends money on. And yeah, they exactly. Certainly spend their money on a lot.
Yep.
Hey, y'all, check it out. The Libertarian Institute, that's me and my friends, have published three great books this year. First is No Quarter, The Ravings of William Norman Grigg. He was the best one of us. Now he's gone, but this great collection is a truly fitting legacy for his fight for freedom. I know you'll love it. Then there's Coming to Palestine by the great Sheldon Richman. It's a collection of 40 important essays he's written over the years about the truth behind the Israel-Palestine conflict. You'll learn so much and highly value this definitive libertarian take on the dispossession of the Palestinians and the reality of their brutal occupation. And last but not least is the great Ron Paul, The Scott Horton Show Interviews, 2004 through 2019. Interview transcripts of all of my interviews of the good doctor over the years on all the wars, money, taxes, the police state, and more. So how do you like that? Pretty good, right? Find them all at libertarianinstitute.org/books. Hey, you guys may know I'm involved in some Libertarian Party politics this year, but you can't hear or read about that at the Libertarian Institute due to 501c3 rules and such. So make sure to sign up for the interviews feed at scotthorton.org and keep an eye on my blog at scotthorton.org/stress. Hey y'all, Scott here. If you want a real education in history and economics, you should check out Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. Tom and a really great group of professors and experts have put together an entire education of everything they didn't teach you in school but should have. Follow through from the link in the margin at scotthorton.org for Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom.
Now, so when you talk about, okay, so it's not going to be a dogfighter and, okay, maybe it can't go supersonic without catching on fire and all this, but it could be useful as a standoff weapon. What exactly does that mean? That means long-range air-to-air missiles for taking out enemy bombers, or that means delivering nuclear-tipped cruise missiles to targets, or what exactly are you talking about there?
Yeah, so kind of all of the above. So try to not get too technical with this, which can happen. We've been covering this stuff for years now. Basically, the core of the F-35 is, you know, we think of it as a stealth fighter, right? That's a simple concept to understand. You can't see it, it gets in, it can shoot your guys. What really people who have dealt with the F-35 program in depth say consistently is the thing that really is cool about this plane is actually the suite of sensors and like radars and joint information sharing on the planes. So one plane can be miles away from the other, and actually they can create a digital map of everything that they're seeing between the two of them to get more information. So people say it's actually one of the best kind of intel gathering systems that we have. So then you compare that with long-range weapons. So again, the case theory is an enemy plane is coming out. You see it long before they see you if you're an F-35, and then you can trigger your weapon. You've got a long-range missile which can hit them, take them out accurately before they're even aware that you're in the area. The other argument is, again, stealth capabilities. It should be able to penetrate into an enemy's airspace, although there's now a lot of questions about particularly with China, has several advanced air defense systems. And there are some people who are arguing, look, the F-35 capability isn't actually going to be able to survive these systems because we designed this stealth capability for a 2005-2006 situation, and that's just not where China's at anymore. In those cases, again, the argument is, well, you put long-range weapons on it, and you have it kind of hanging around and firing. There's been talk about using it for missile defense capabilities. The Pentagon is something that they're looking at, is the idea of you could put a bunch of F-35s near North Korea, and if they try to launch a missile, you could actually kinetically strike it while it's just at the very early stages. You also see a lot of people talking about, again, the sensors and the information gathering. Maybe there's a way that they should be filling more of that role. If it sounds like there's a lot of people looking for ways to use the F-35, in maybe ways that it wouldn't obviously be the one that you would first think about, that's absolutely the case. People are saying, look, we got to figure out what to do with these things and how to use them in a kind of current world operation. A lot of this just goes back to the fact this thing was first planned out in 2001, so which means that the requirements for it from the Pentagon go back to 1998, 1999. The world was a different place. The U.S. was the only true great power. Even 2001, we spent the next decade bombing people with no real air defenses. The China in the situation, in the meantime, China and Russia both invested heavily in their air defenses. Particularly China took a major leap. Russia has the S-400, which you've probably heard a lot about, which is also capable. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. kind of wasn't paying attention to what those countries were doing as it developed the F-35, because, again, it was very focused on kind of just the situation in the Middle East, where this wasn't a major issue. And now everyone's trying to figure out, okay, it's 2020. The world is what it is. We have to figure out the best ways to use these things.
Yeah. All right. So that really brings up the question about, America's relationship with Russia and China and the military's attitude about all that. But I wanted to ask you one question first about the stealth coding on here. There's this report, you know, if you fly it fast, the stealth coding peels off. But I'm not sure if it was Mandy Smithberger or who it was I had talked to about this years ago, said that, you know, the same goes for the F-117 and the B-2, as well as the F-22 and the F-35. They're not stealthy at all. All you have to do is point a World War II era long wave radar at them, as opposed to the more modern kind, and they jump right out. They're not stealthy in any sense. And believe you me, the Russians have long wave radars. And that was, I think, suspected as one of the reasons that the Serbs were able to shoot down that one, F-117 in the Kosovo War of 1999. And so I wonder if in your reporting that's come up very much.
Yeah, I've certainly talked with Mandy a lot of times about this. I think we probably disagree a little bit on it. I don't think it's that simple. Certainly, yeah, the F-117 was shot down in Serbia, and that was kind of a big wake-up call. The F-117 also was built in the early 1980s, and that was a very different stealth coding than what the B-2 has, which is different from the F-22, which is different from the F-35. I haven't ever really come across something that says it's simple as you push a strong radar at it and it's going to totally ping. Now, part of the issue is the way stealth is, you know, and we tend to think of, okay, it's stealth coding, the whole plane's stealth, you can't see it. A lot of what stealth actually is in the design of the plane. And that's why you see, you know, the B-2 is kind of this weird design, and the F-117, if you go back and look at it, has a lot of weird angles to it. The same is true for the F-22 and the F-35. If you actually get up close to an F-35, there's weird bumps and kind of strange angles, particularly on the bottom. And that's to create a stealth profile. The issue is, you mentioned the ability to carry weapons earlier in this conversation. For an F-35 to kind of be loaded up, you got to put weapons on the wings. And if you do that, then the stealth design, the shape, which is supposed to have radar flow off of it, even with stealth coding that's working perfectly, you're going to see stuff because, hey, you've got missiles, and that messes up the thing, and that's going to ping on the radar. So that's an issue, because while it can carry some weapons internally to really go into a full-on situation that you'd want for, again, kind of standoff capability to be able to launch a bunch of weapons, you got to put things on the wings, and that's going to mess up the stealth capabilities and make you ping. So that's one of the trade-offs that, again, when I say people are trying to figure out how to use these things, it's, okay, in what mission are we willing to accept that lack of stealth to carry more weapons in which missions do we feel we need to do everything we can to get as much stealth as possible.
Yeah. All right. Now, so let me ask you here in the last few minutes about our military's attitude toward Russia and China. You know, I wanted to talk with you about this article that I thought was brand new, and it turns out it was 2 years old. But anyway, I've read you on this subject and a lot of other people writing about the subject of the new Cold Wars with Russia and China and, you know, war games, various war games, red team and blue team and this kind of thing. There was a report not long ago that says, oh, well, if we fight Russia in Eastern Europe and China in East Asia at the same time, we'll lose and all this kind of stuff. But one thing that I've noticed in years of this is that the existence, the possession of thousands of hydrogen bombs by America and Russia and at least hundreds by China, of course, goes without saying. Everybody knows it. And yet it goes completely unsaid because it goes without saying, maybe. And so you seem to have all kinds of proposals and plans and war games and game theories and who knows what that revolve around America going to war with Russia and Eastern Europe, or going, having, you know, some kind of naval confrontation with China over Taiwan or something else. And this fantasy that somehow we could have these wars, one or both at the same time, and that nuclear weapons just wouldn't even be at play. Don't even worry about that at all. Now, they'll have a little war game where they say, well, what if we used a tactical nuke and then they used a big one and this and that? But that's kind of separate. It seems like you get these, you know, real in-depth kind of plans and conversations centered around these battles that don't even include the idea of nukes even being brought up at all. So could we win a conventional war with Russia in Eastern Europe when that's not one of the options? A war with Russia in Eastern Europe means we lose our entire civilization. Everybody already knows that, but somehow we pretend that that's not so. And maybe we could have a real great set piece battle over there. So what's the deal?
Yeah, you know, it's a couple of things. I think first you got to start with kind of what the Pentagon is. And what the Pentagon is a five-sided building that produces papers. And every one of those papers has, you know, a lot of people who spend a lot of time thinking about these things and coming up with policies and strategies and what ifs. And there is a large binder for invading, going to war with five times different ways with every country in this world. And we have, I'm sure somewhere in the building, there is a intensely in-depth strategy for invading Canada. It's just what the Pentagon does. They have whole teams whose jobs are just to, okay, who are we figuring out if we have to go war with this country? How do we do it? So that's part of it. Obviously, Russia and China stand out because they are the other great powers, right? Part of with Russia particularly, the idea of, oh, we'll have tank wars in Eastern Europe is, you know, there's a saying that people in D.C. use a lot in this world, which is, people are policy. And in this case, you got to remember the people who are now running the Pentagon came up and were trained in the military academies in the late 1980s. So while they actually fought in wars in the Middle East, and that's where they've cut their teeth, they grew up reading and studying and thinking about, well, we're going to have the great tank wars in Poland, and here's the great Cold War stuff. And there's a little bit, particularly in the Army, of, hey, that would be kind of cool to get back to that. And ooh, now we get to actually, you know, think about this stuff and maybe have our little war games with this stuff. So that's part of it, too, that I think is driving that interest once Russia popped back up in 2014 and invaded Ukraine. In terms of the nuclear stuff, it's actually interesting. Under the Trump administration, there was a big report called the Nuclear Posture Review, which came out in early 2018. And essentially what that was a relook at nuclear weapons for America, what we have, what we need, what our strategy is for deployment. The idea was always mutual assured destruction, right? The idea, as you mentioned, if Russia would never use nuclear weapons because, you know, we would use our nuclear weapons and we'd all die. Russia, in particular, has invested a lot in the last 10 years in kind of, for lack of better terms, irregular, quote-unquote, tactical nuclear weapons. People who study this stuff will pretty much agree there's no such thing as a tactical nuclear weapon. It's just a lower-geared nuke. But they've invested a lot of kind of these smaller nuclear weapons. And there's a belief among certainly the more hawkish members of the military community that Russia has a stance that, okay, if we ever had to face off against the U.S., we'll use a couple of these small nukes in Europe and the U.S. will freak out and say, well, we can't use our big nukes and wipe them out because they didn't use their big nukes. And that's an escalation we don't want to cross. So they'll get away with it and we'll just have to back off because they have these smaller nuclear weapons. That theory is controversial in a lot of circles, let's say, but it's a theory that's driven a lot of work that went into this nuclear posture review. Coming out of that, the Trump administration decided to invest in new nuclear capabilities. One of those is a lower yield, kind of smaller than the weapon that was used in Hiroshima, submarine launched nuclear missile, which is already now active. They were able to very quickly turn that project around. There's a second future lower yield weapon that they're just starting new research on. But again, this is this new policy from the Trump administration that was very different from both the Obama Bush administrations, saying if our enemies are going to have small tactical nuclear weapons that they could potentially use trying to stay under the threshold of mutually assured destruction, we need to have those weapons to convince them they can't use those weapons. And on the spiral goes, and a lot of money gets spent for weapons that I think we can all agree we hope never see deployed.
Yeah, I mean, and this is really the problem for the Pentagon, right, is that Earth is only so big, and there are only so many powers in the world. And the Cold War with the Soviet communists is over 30 years now, and they're not any kind of world power in any sense, really, unless you just want to pretend really hard to believe, I mean, even as you just said, that they invaded Ukraine, when they never invaded Ukraine. They sent special operations forces across the border to help the people of eastern Ukraine defend themselves from invasion by their own government. But they never invaded the country, as Sergey Lavrov said in the WikiLeaks. Hey, if we wanted to, we could be in Kiev in 2 weeks. You know that. They never pushed that. They have no designs on the Baltic states or whatever. It's the Americans who are chomping at the bit for some kind of fight there.
I'm going to respectfully disagree with that point, Scott, but we probably don't have time to get into that one fully.
Okay, well, all right. It's kind of a funny place to leave it. Did they send the infantry across? Did they absorb any territory?
I mean, there's been an incredible... Well, yes. I mean, first off, they absorbed Crimea.
Well,
which, whether you can argue that should have been or not, it was a part of Ukraine and no longer is. It's now part of Russia. I mean, we can't argue that point, right?
Well, it's hardly an invasion, but that's not what you were referring to anyway. You were talking about the Donbass, right?
Yeah, and there's ongoing conflicts there still. And I mean, we've seen plenty of open source information out there saying that we can track Russian units that are, you know, taking their patches off and then crossing the border.
Sure. And it's still a matter of defense for the Russian speakers of the East after the American coup of February 2014 and the declaration of the war on terrorism by the government there. It's not like the Russians just decided to invade eastern Ukraine. So it's, you know, again, yeah, they had their personnel there, but to say that's the dawn of a new era of Russian aggressiveness is kind of silly, don't you think?
Again, I think we're going to have to respectfully disagree on what happened there.
Okay. Well, you do know about the coup d'etat of February 22nd and how the democratically elected government was overthrown by American-backed right-wing thugs, etc., right?
Again, I think there's different viewpoints on what happened there.
Okay. Well, anyway, great talk. I really appreciate your time on the show.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me.
All right, you guys, that is Aaron Mehta writing for Defense News. That's defensenews.com. This one is called 5 F-35 Issues Have Been Downgraded, But They Remain Unsolved. The Scott Horton Show, Anti-War Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.